trying to make sure that my loved ones are okay. But I also work on climate. This is my job. And I, as soon as I start thinking about that statement from President Biden, I just get so incensed. This is a climate emergency. There's no practically declared it. You either believe it or not. And I think as bad as Republicans have been by denying climate, Democrats are just as culpable by not doing enough. Scientists say that we need to be investing at least $1 trillion a year in the clean energy transition. We need to end and phase out, deny all new fossil fuel permits, and really empower the communities to build back ourselves democratically. That's the solution for it. And President Biden announced his second term, but he hasn't told us how he's going to finish the job. He needs to lay out that vision, what we've been demanding from a Green New Deal, if he wants communities that got him elected to come out, that base of climate voters that happen to be predominantly Black, Indigenous, and low-income people. Like, we need something forward-looking to come out, because right now, like, I'm not even thinking about voting, right? Like, nobody in Lahaina is thinking about whether or not they support Biden. Like, give us something. You know, at least let us be seen. So, you know, I think that's that sense of urgency. Even me, who is in this climate work full time and see these events unfold elsewhere, until it hits you at home and it's people you know, grocery stores you shop at, schools your kids go to, your church after you've been burnt down, you're not going to understand the urgency. Like, it is shocking. We're not talking 10 years from now. These things are happening right now. It could happen to your home tomorrow. That's the urgency we're dealing with, and we need to act accordingly. So no, practically speaking, like, we need to move now and do everything we can.
And can you tell us more about the importance of Indigenous wisdom and practices in addressing the climate catastrophe?
Sure. Yeah. So going into Lahaina, the people that actually live there for generations are the keepers of some of the most profound Indigenous knowledge that I have ever met. They understood subsistence fishery, how native plants were buffers against, like, you know, disasters, how to, you know, create regenerative agricultural practices. And It's that view of the world where, you know, our success isn't determined by how much we hoard, but rather how much we produce for others and share, and where, like, our economy is not based on how well the rich are doing, but how many people, how many of us can actually thrive. Like, It's not just Indigenous knowledge, but it's that value system that really needs to be reestablished. So, you know, I think over the years, especially in my line of work, there's been more resources for Indigenous folks to lead frontline fights against bad projects. But the intervention that really needs to happen is Indigenous leaders also need to be resourced to build the good. They need to be the purveyors of and architects of the new green and, like, community rooted world that's still possible, even in these dire times.
Finally, would you like to leave us with some images that you have been living through over these last few days, like the banyan tree, where you show us when you put out on social media the before and after the wildfires, but other images or stories of people's bravery in trying to preserve what you have known for so long?
Yeah, I mean, as we're speaking, there's people that still haven't found their loved ones. A lot of the friends that I grew up with, like, I come from a lower income neighborhood, they're firefighters. I ran into one on the way here. And I'm just like, hey, y'all are doing a great job. And he was just sweating and like started crying and, you know, barely looked like he hasn't slept in days. Hotels are letting residents in without cost to sleep. Multiple businesses are just letting people drop off goods and they're shipping it 3 to 4 times a day. They're leaving their doors open 24 hours. So there is that sense of, you know, this is an island. We're all in this together. And that sense of mutual aid and solidarity is really carrying us through. And it's been quite remarkable to witness. But, you know, don't want to leave you with some toxic positivity either. Like, these are hard times. And unless we take urgent action now, it'll only get worse.
And what is the, do you feel is the most important thing that President Biden, the federal government, people should be pushing for right now?
Well, right now we need direct aid, but there needs to be a longer focus on recovery, that these, we can't rebuild the community in a few weeks. It's going to take years. And we need to do it intentionally, not just making sure, not just bringing us back to the status quo, because the status quo is what led us here, but making sure that we have more democratic and community controlled institutions that come out of this. Unfortunately, the groups that are best poised to deploy direct aid because of their institutional connections are also the most likely to enable disaster capitalists from exploiting this situation. So we need to create, we need to understand that, you know, as we're like trying, as people want to help, that they're resourcing groups that have an eye towards community organizations to organizers that will actually be there once the cameras leave, and we'll be rebuilding from the ground up over the course of the long run.
And one more time, can you tell us why the banyan tree is so important?
Yeah, I mean, the banyan tree is so iconic. There's like 16 trunks. It's the largest in the United States. It just turned 150 years old in April. And the images of it being completely toasted is heartbreaking. Now, I have hope, because trees have deep roots, especially of that age, that it will continue on. And, you know, that's the vision in my mind, right? Like, as we rebuild as a community, as we realize the vision of a Green New Deal nationally and globally, the banyan tree also regrows its leaves and is a positive symbol for what's to come.
Kaniela Ng, the National Director of the Green New Deal Network's seventh generation Native Hawaiian, speaking to us from Maui. And I especially thank my little pup, Zazu, for staying quiet during that interview, which makes me think about all of the fauna and the flora destroyed as well on Maui. And of course, most importantly, the people. Coming up, we speak to another Native Hawaiian activist and a fire scientist at the University of Hawaii. Back in 20 seconds.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary Jane. Sugar man, metaphor's friend, on a lonely, dusty road.
Sugar man. By Rodriguez, Sixto Rodriguez, the subject of the 2012 Oscar-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man, passed away this week at the age of 81
in his home in Detroit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we get an update now on the impacts of the wildfire in Lahaina, the area in West Maui that's of historical importance to indigenous people, entire neighborhoods wiped out by the wildfire, including the Na'akaini o Maui Cultural Center, which had a massive archive lost to the flames. The head of the center said, quote, the place is burnt to the ground. We're joined now on Maui by Noelani Ahia, a Kanaka Maoli activist, longtime organizer in Lahaina Town. She's also the co-founder of the organization Mauna Medic Healers Hui and is involved in mutual aid efforts as the community responds to the devastation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Noelani. It is an honor to have you with us. Can you describe from your vantage point where you are, and especially the cultural center is the center of Lahaina in terms of what has been lost at the center and overall in the town?
Yes, thank you so much, Amy. It's so good to be here. Na'akaini o Maui Cultural Center was founded about 20 years ago in historic Lahaina Town, and it happens to sit adjacent to a very sacred area of Maui called Moku'ula and Moku'hinia. And this is a traditional place, what we would call a wahipana, or a sacred place, dating back to the 1500s, where one of our former kings who presided over the islands with peace lived, and his sacred family was birthed there. And we have stories that carry us down today that connect us back to that place, that reroute us. And this island, Moku'ula, was in the middle of a wetland. It was lush and beautiful and green. Because of settler colonialism and because of the impositions of the settler government, it was covered over a long time ago, and there's baseball fields now on it and tennis courts. And the Na'akaini o Maui Cultural Center has been working to get the access in order to restore Moku'ula and to clean it up and make sure it's a place of reverence again. And the folks at Na'akaini have been working for decades on all kinds of issues, protecting burials, protecting land right issues, and just generally being there for the community to provide classes and workshops and cultural practice and cultural protocol. And that building also housed a collection of artifacts, as well as historical documents, old maps, just priceless things that are all lost. In the blink of an eye, it was burned to the ground, and all of those things are lost. It also had a collection from an esteemed kupuna, esteemed elder named Sam Ka'ai, whose collection was being housed there. And for this kupuna, this elder, this was his life's work. This was, he's 85 now, and this was 50 years worth of carvings that he himself did, of collecting items from all over the South Pacific when he traveled on the Hokulea double-hulled canoe voyaging project back in the 80s. And I had the burden, you could say, of telling him yesterday that his collection was gone. And it was devastating. It was devastating. This is this man's life work. And he created all of these things, not for himself, but for future generations to understand how brilliant our Kanaka Maoli people are and how ingenious we were, because so much of that history and that culture was lost to us after the overthrow and with the new government and the wave of people that came in and took over lands. Particularly, we're talking about, you know, the plantations and the oligarchy that Kaniela was talking about. So many Hawaiians were dispossessed from their land, and we lost so much of our culture, including our language. And so when a kupuna, when an elder like this dedicates his life to retrieving and retracing and remembering those pieces of ourselves that that allowed us to live here on this isolated island, how to make tools, how to make rope, how to make the instruments that feed us, all of these things that allowed us to have life and survive here, all of those things that he dedicated his life to are now a memory. But I will say, he told me yesterday morning that he woke up having a dream about seeds. And what he said was he saw us planting seeds back in that ash. He saw us putting back our traditional plant, our traditional medicines, our kalo plant, our taro, which is very sacred to us. We're ancestrally connected to the kalo. He saw us putting those things back in the ground so that new life can come again. And for somebody of his age who's closer to moving into the next realm than many of us, for him to still be thinking about the next generation and still be thinking about what the future could be in Lahaina, for me is the measure of what it means to be Indigenous and what it means to be genealogically connected to this land.
No, Lania, here, it is so painful to talk to you right now at this moment with the destruction that your island has undergone. If you could talk about the mutual mm-hmm. aid efforts. You know, we first of all, in the rest of the corporate media, we hear almost no Native voices, no Native Hawaiians, and why it's so important to hear your voices. And then what is happening on the ground? You know, there's a big debate now, like, why weren't people alerted earlier? Where was the early alert system? Why were people just looking out the window or smelling the smoke and seeing the fire right in front of them? And how important that is. But also, it's just described Lahaina as a great tourist destination, how tourism has affected the whole environment, if you could speak about that as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You know, it's very disturbing for us as Kanaka Maoli to see the headlines and talk about, you know, see Lahaina as this tourist town, as if that's all it is. Because for us, it's so much more, and the tourism is part of the commodification of our culture. It's part of the erasure of our culture. That narrative literally just takes us out of the picture. And, you know, without Hawaiians, there would be no Hawaii. Everybody loves aloha, but they forget about the people that breathe aloha into the world, the root and the source of aloha. So, and that's the Kanaka Maoli people. The over-tourism, the overdevelopment, the dispossession of Kanaka Maoli from our lands, the monocropping, as Kaniela Ing was talking about, those are all things that contributed to the conditions that created this. And, you know, as we live on an island, there's only so much space and there's only so much room and there's only so much resources. And for over 130 years, our water has been diverted to go to those sugar plantations and pineapple fields. So what used to be a lush, verdant Lahaina, in fact, I'll tell you a little something that the Lahaina is not an old name. One of the older names for Lahaina is Malaulu Olele, and it means land of the flying breadfruit, because Lahaina used to be covered in breadfruit, which is a staple for the Hawaiian diet. It's incredibly nutritious. It's being studied the world over to help with food sovereignty in underprivileged areas. It's just an amazing, rich, rich historical plant for us. And Lahaina was covered with ulu until the sugar plantations came in and chopped it all down. And they permanently changed our ecosystem, that one act. That on top of the diversion of water for the plantations, what's happening now that the plantations have shut down is unscrupulous developers are diverting the water and banking it for real estate. And it's not real estate for the Kanaka Maoli or the local people. It's for foreign investors. It's for gentlemen's estate farms that have giant swimming pools. It's for, excuse me, really inappropriate use of one of our most sacred resources. In fact, the name for water in Hawaii is wai. And the name for wealth in Hawaii is vai vai, which means if you have water, you have life. But our water has been taken away from us, and it's left us in this dry, barren, almost unrecognizable. It would be unrecognizable to our ancestors, this condition that we're currently living under, the settler government. So, You combine the dispossession with the over-tourism, with the overdevelopment, and you have this trifecta for disaster. And that's what we're seeing today. It's absolute disaster. It's absolute devastation.
And Noilani, we only have a minute, and then we're going to go to a fire scientist at the University of Hawaii. But the mutual aid efforts on the ground, those grassroots efforts that are saving everyone.
Thank you. The mutual aid group in Maui has mobilized. We're working with them. We've got medics, food distribution. We're working on organizing housing for people. But one of the issues that we're having is we're being prevented access. And it's really, really disappointing because the people on the ground know what the community needs. The people on the ground self-organize and are able to move fast, quickly, and get the needs of the people where they need to go. But unfortunately, there has been some blocking of those efforts, and it's always done under the guise of safety. But when our people are in Lahaina and they're suffering because they don't have any food and they don't have any water and we're not allowed to get them resources, it's really, really challenging. So we're finding some unique ways to get resources to people. Folks have been taking boats around from the other side of the island in order to get resources in. And we've been using whatever methods we can to get the needs of the people met. But it's a beautiful effort. The people on the ground are so strong and so resilient and so ready to jump in to help one another. We say aloha ke kahi I ke kahi. That means love going out, love coming back. And one of my good friends said today, your disaster emergency kit must include community. Community is first. And that's really what it's about, is taking care of each other.
Noilani Ahia, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and all the very best. Kanaka Maoli activist, longtime organizer in Lahaina, co-founder of the organization Mauna Medic Healers Hui. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We go now from Maui to end today's show looking at how the deadly wildfires that spread through Maui came after weeks of worsening drought conditions as the climate emergency fuels deadly fires across the globe. The U.S. Drought Monitor reports nearly 16% of Maui County is now facing a severe drought. An additional 20% is facing moderate drought. We're joined in Honolulu by Clay Trauernecht, professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where he focuses on wildland fire management in Hawaii and the Pacific. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Clay Trauernecht. It's great to have you with us. Put these two issues together. You have the hurricane hundreds of miles away, creates hurricane winds that fuel these wildfires, and how this is connected to climate change.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I'd just like to say how much I appreciate you highlighting the voices of your prior guests to kind of round out the perspective on this incident. But in terms of these the climate or weather events that we've seen, we had the combination of the storm passing to the south and this high pressure system that really ramped up winds and lowered relative humidity over the course of a couple of days. And what's really important to understand is that those really rapid changes in weather can have huge effects on fire danger. But the reason that they're having the effects they are is because of the landscape scale changes that your prior guests were mentioning. And that's the change in the vegetation surrounding the community in Lahaina, as well as the community upcountry Maui, which is experiencing similar fires and is still, which are still burning right now. And these are changes that have affected most of the island in the state, in the sense that these change in land use over the past couple decades, the decline in agricultural production has really resulted in the dramatic expansion of these non-native tropical grasses. And this really creates this vulnerability that we're seeing right now and the really explosive growth in fire that we saw over the past couple days.
Were you surprised by the scale of this disaster? And now this debate over where were the early warning, you know, so many deaths, and there are probably a number more, how it could have been dealt with in a different way. I mean, you have the governor saying this is the worst natural disaster in Hawaii's history.
Yeah, I think we're clearly grappling with the human toll. This is something that's absolutely unprecedented, and I don't think, I mean, just the loss and hearing these stories that you of your prior guests, I mean, this is going to, it's still sinking in for all of us just how dramatic this is and just what the impact that this has had on the people, like, first of all, first and foremost. As far as the unprecedented nature of these fires. Unfortunately, this is something we've been seeing over the past decade at least. And we can look back to 2019, where 21 homes were lost in West Maui due to similar fires. The same year, we had about 20,000 acres burned through central Maui. 2018, we actually had a near pass of another hurricane system that coincided with large-scale fires on Oahu, on the west side of Oahu. And in each of these incidents, what we're seeing, I think as your first guest mentioned, is our the firefighters we have on the ground, that those are the resources we have. They were spread incredibly thin over this past week. They're, you know, doing everything that they can. And as far as what we can do, and by we, I mean the response agencies that we work with, the nonprofits, Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization, I have to give them credit too, but we're trying to get the word out and identify the actions that communities and land managers can take prior to these fires, and so that we can reduce risk, create safer conditions, and sort of relieve the burden, which at this point really falls onto our emergency responders. Another element or dimension to this change in land use, or the limited management we see on these lands, these tropical grasslands that cover the state, is about 1 million acres, is that as those operations have kind of removed from the landscape, you lose a lot of the knowledge that was there from the workers who knew where the roads were maintaining the roads, maintaining water access. So again, all of this burden falls on our firefighters, and we're asking them to do really heavy lifting. And up until this incident, we also have to say they've done a commendable job of really protecting our communities. This is, as you said, this is the worst we've ever seen, and all of the fires that we have seen over the past couple decades since agriculture has been declining, our firefighters are typically very successful at protecting homes, infrastructure, and human lives.
Professor Trownick, President Biden has pledged disaster relief, immediate assistance to those affected. But what would it mean if he actually outright declared not just a state emergency in Hawaii, a national climate emergency, a national state of emergency?
It's a difficult question for Hawaii. We struggle here having long-term funding in place. And part of that reason, as far as the relationship with the federal government, and again, I can only really speak to the fire realm, fire management realm, is that we don't have these large tracts of federal land. And that's usually the mechanism through which, you know, National Forest, Bureau of Land Management, these are the mechanisms, at least in the continental U.S., that funding kind of comes in for this kind of work. And what we're talking about for a disaster like this, to prevent the next one, is to support these efforts on the ground that are actually altering the condition of those fuels. And there are lots of examples, lots of people working on this, ranging from working with ranchers to do targeted grazing, doing fuel break networks to give firefighters a fighting chance, re-implementing traditional agriculture. There's examples of folks restoring taro, lo'i wetland taro, to actually act as fire breaks, all the way through to reforestation, where we're converting these fuels into something else, something less likely to burn. And I think, you know, our job, what we've been working on, the folks doing fire prevention work for the number of years now, is just how do we scale this up? And so that's really what we need to be thinking about with assistance from the federal government, is how can we implement these actions that, and the knowledge that people already have, how can we do that at larger scales, coordinate across bigger spaces? And this is something that needs to happen statewide.
Professor Clay Charnek, we thank you so much for being with us from the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Radio Rewind.